Welcome to a special holiday edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Ron, and I'm really, really excited about tonight's debate.
Well, we should tell the listener that, of course, we are taping this on Thursday morning, and there will be a debate, the final debate before the Iowa caucuses. Before the Iowa caucuses. And so, of course, you will hear this podcast after, basically, Rick Santorum wipes the floor with his opponents.
Yes, I'm expecting Rick to wipe the floor. I would say that people could listen to the podcast while they're watching the debate, and we could interpret what they're hearing in the debate, because we already know what the candidates are going to say.
But we do know that this is the only opportunity to make their case before January 3rd, and basically, that's how they've been running their campaign. They've not been on the ground. There's not been organization troops.
Not
in
the traditional way.
No, and even commercials only recently have Romney, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Perry, and Ron Paul as well, have been putting up the ads. But it's really been all about debates. And this will be the second consecutive debate where Newt Gingrich is the target.
Yes, he is the front runner, the putative front runner in all the polls. He's ahead in Iowa in the polls that everyone has done in Iowa. And he's also, of course, way ahead in the new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll
nationally.
That came out this week.
Nationally. Yeah, well, that doesn't mean anything.
Well, all right.
As President Rudy Giuliani would tell you.
That's correct. And I have made the comparison to Rudy Giuliani. And, of course, they're very different political personalities in every way. But Rudy Giuliani had about a 2-to-1 lead over John McCain in the fall of 2007.
Yeah.
And now Newt has, in these national polls, about the same kind of lead over Mitt Romney. But, of course, as we know, John McCain wound up with the nomination. And actually, Rudy Giuliani didn't win anything.
Well, yeah, one difference is that we do expect Newt Gingrich could very well win Iowa. But look, just like everybody knew that Rudy Giuliani was not the conservative choice for the Republican nomination.
Conservatives were telling pollsters that he was.
But he was pro-choice. He was pro-gay rights. He was things that are anathema to what the Republicans have stood for since Ronald Reagan.
All right, but there are similarly torpedo-like things out there in the water for Newt Gingrich, or are there? Do we just assume that everybody knows all the bad stuff about Newt Gingrich and they've already processed it and accepted it?
They've been saying it nonstop for the past couple of weeks about everything from Freddie Mac.
Yeah, but that was true with Giuliani, too. We were constantly
saying. And he went nowhere.
And in the end, he went nowhere, but in part, in the end, he went nowhere because he didn't enter. He didn't really contest Iowa. He didn't really contest New Hampshire. He tried to start his campaign in Florida. Newt Gingrich isn't going to make that mistake.
No, that's true.
He is out there in every event, and one would expect at this point that he should easily win in South Carolina, even if he doesn't win in Iowa or New Hampshire. And as you say, he could win in Iowa.
And you know, the last Republican to win both Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, okay, I would say George H.W. Bush in 92, but before that, you have to go way back.
To Gerald Ford in 76, right? I mean, the thing is, usually we see different winners coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire, and right now the latest polls, of course, have Romney still up in New Hampshire. But 4 years ago this time, Romney had a huge lead in New Hampshire, and once he collapsed in Iowa, he collapsed in New Hampshire as well.
Yes, but he collapsed to a candidate who New Hampshire liked, John McCain. They had already liked John McCain in 2000. It's not as easy to see Newt Gingrich winning over New Hampshire as it was to see John McCain do it last time.
I'm going to say Newt Gingrich is necessarily going to win. I'm going to say that if Romney does worse than expected on January 3rd in Iowa, there could be reverberations a week later in New Hampshire.
Yes, and certainly there would be one way or another. The interesting thing at this particular moment is I'm not absolutely sure Newt Gingrich is going to win in Iowa.
Really?
I see movement on the part of Ron Paul. He's come way up. He's near 20% in some of these polls. And we know that his voters tend to be more reliable, that they're not just parking their vote with Ron Paul. They're really seriously interested in Ron Paul.
It's always been the case, except more than ever this year.
Yes. And with Newt Gingrich, he does appear to have been sort of the flavor of the month after the Herman Cain collapse, after the Rick Perry collapse, after the Michelle Bachmann collapse. A lot of people went to him who were looking for the anti-Mitt. We've said this before. Right now, Newt, so close to the Iowa caucuses, would seem to be not just the flavor of the month, but where those voters are going to wind up. So that's why people are taking him so seriously.
And yet, at the same time, if you look at the attacks on Newt Gingrich in the last couple of days, they're far more severe than they were against Bachmann or Perry or Cain, mostly about the fact that he's unreliable. He's an unreliable conservative. For Mitt Romney to say that, I mean, there's almost an irony and almost like, what is that all about? And yet he did the same thing attacking Huckabee and McCain back in 2007, 2008 as well.
Didn't
unreliable.
Do much good.
No, it didn't. But there are so many things about the polls, about whether Barack Obama would beat Newt Gingrich. I mean, you know, we saw what Bill Clinton did to Newt Gingrich in 1996 as a foil. And I would make the case it's a wiser Newt Gingrich now than it was then. But still, at the same time, I still think that, you know, his ideas would not win over the vast middle of the country that ostensibly Romney has a shot at getting.
That's right. And it would seem as though in every poll that I've seen, Romney still does the best against Obama in a straight up. And ultimately, is that not what the Republicans care most about?
No, I don't know.
It may not be. If they would rather have a Goldwater 1964, then so be it. That could be their choice. But it seems to me, from everything that I have heard and read, and every person that I've talked to, that the Republicans are more concerned about denying Barack Obama a second term than they are about ideological purity. And if it comes down to that, they'll vote for Mitt Romney. And if it comes down to that, they'll accept Mitt Romney as their nominee, even in this process, if the only last alternative is someone as difficult and spiky as Newt Gingrich. Look at the National Review. The National Review doesn't even like to do endorsements, but they've done an anti-endorsement against Newt Gingrich. And there is a long, long line of conservative commentators with large followings who do not find Newt Gingrich acceptable. That's got to be a problem for a lot of Republican primary voters.
It's especially a problem because we've heard the last couple of months that Mitt Romney is unacceptable to a lot of these conservatives, certainly the ministers in Iowa and a lot of the strong conservatives in South Carolina, that he's just unacceptable.
Are you talking about Mormonism here? Are you talking strictly about ideology of an economic kind social
policy? Certainly it's ideology, but at the same time, it could be this cult of Mormonism, as the Gingrich aide said this week in Iowa before he was fired. So, I mean, that's out there. But, of course, if it's not Gingrich and if it's not Romney, then who is it? I mean, it's not, you know, it's Tim Pawlenty, maybe.
Well, it does appear that a scenario arises here that if Mitt Romney cannot overcome this challenge from Newt Gingrich, but if Newt Gingrich is not acceptable to conventional Republicans or even to a wide swath of very conservative Republicans, then they're going to have to come up with some other way to find a nominee. It might have to be some kind of draft. It might have to be some kind of convention.
I'm smiling because
I know.
That's the fantasy.
That's the fantasy, the political junkie fantasy. But if you have the nomination split between two guys the party doesn't want, and neither of them has really nailed it down by the time we get into February, March, April, May, does the party not have to seek other means in order to find somebody who can, A, beat Barack Obama, and, B, unite the party?
You know, that's how they got James Garfield in 1880.
And it's how they got Wendell Willkie, I suppose, in 1940. But
look, we know that for all our fondness for 1880 and 1940, and we were there, but it's not going to happen. Although it's interesting, the White House obviously is very happy about a protracted Gingrich versus Romney battle because they think, obviously, the longer this goes on, the less time the Republicans will focus on their ultimate enemy, Barack Obama.
Well, and plus, the more it divides the Republican Party and makes people less than enthusiastic in the end for the summer, for the fall. Yes, any incumbent would love to see the other party digest itself in an effort to find a challenger. I'm not so sure that in the end this is going to be that great a deal for Barack Obama. And we don't really know what the dynamic of the campaign is going to be next year because we don't know where the economy will be and what other kind of foreign crises may be developing. I mean, there's increasing anxiety about Iran, for example, and what may be necessary or what may be seen as necessary by the federal government with respect to Iran in the next 6 or 8 months. So any number of things could dramatically change the landscape. Right now, the Republicans just need to settle on a horse.
Who's going to be the horse?
I still think it's going to be Mitt Romney.
Yeah, me too.
And I realize that that's dull, and I realize that that's kind of brain dead, but I just can't see the path. Even if Gingrich wins Iowa, even if it's close in New Hampshire, even if Gingrich wins South Carolina and ultimately Florida.
And you know the history of South Carolina.
Yes, South Carolina picks the nominee.
Every time since 1980.
Except that there's one step there. South Carolina goes first and triggers the next set of larger southern states, which go the same way.
Right.
Now, if South Carolina should choose Gingrich, but Florida does not, that would break that string right there.
True.
And that, I would say, would restore the possibility of Romney pulling it out. Plus, we have all these events on Super Tuesday, March 6th, and it's conceivable that by then Romney has righted his ship and countered this force that's currently coming from Newt Gingrich, a lot of which, I believe, is still a polling phenomenon, and the long-term lasting power of which is not clear.
Just a quick interruption. One thing we don't know about March 6th is whether Texas will be one of those states in Super Tuesday, because the Supreme Court has agreed to take up their redistricting case. The Republicans had one map. A three-judge panel came up with another one that basically favored Latinos and the Democrats. And so the Supreme Court said they'll take it up on January 9th, but they may change the date to April. And if that does that, not that Rick Perry is likely to be the nominee anyway, but he was basing a big showing on March 6th, the day of the Texas primary, and that may be pushed back to April.
It's also possible Rick Perry's out of the picture entirely by
exactly,
March.
I know.
If he does as poorly as he might do in the January events, it's hard to see him surviving. Here's one major disappointment.
I know what you're going to say. I
have to say, I just really don't know what I'm going to do with that week between Christmas and New Year's, which was going to be anchored by the candidates' debate moderated by Donald Trump.
I know. I think it would have been a great opportunity to see Rick Santorum versus Newt Gingrich, just as John Huntsman versus Newt Gingrich was one of the best.
It was really, really. I think it's still going on, actually. That was a foreign policy debate. It lasted a long, long time.
I miss Lincoln and
I
Douglas.
Think they touched every country. Let's put it this way. The Trump debate came down to being only Santorum and Gingrich because all the other candidates said they didn't want a Trump-moderated debate.
Well,
why?
No.
Why? Did they not want to be outshone?
No. The ostensible reason was...
The ostensible reason was that
Donald Trump is talking about running as an independent.
And he still is.
Yeah, he's still talking. But first of all, you know he's not going to run. He always talks about running, and he's not going to give up his TV show and his all the stuff so he can run at a ridiculous third-party independent candidacy for president.
You mean like Sarah Palin did?
Well, she didn't do that either.
Oh.
But the real reason is it would have been a circus.
And, if people want just a circus, they
could listen
to the podcast.
It's all politics.
So I would say that there was just a moment when Newsmax announced that it was going to have this debate. It was a huge publicity thing for Newsmax, much as these other debates have been for other news organizations. And they had just this instant when they thought they had all the candidates, and then they announced Donald Trump would be the moderator, and they blew it. Because in the end, it isn't because he might be an independent candidate
for
president.
It's because he's Donald Trump.
He's Donald Trump, and he gives this kind of tabloid sort of character to the entire proceeding and makes all the other candidates look like they're sort of trained SEALs who would do anything to get on television.
But look at them. They still go up to New York all the time to kiss his ring, right? And they go, and that's the weirdest thing.
Not so much anymore. And clearly, to get an endorsement, some of these candidates will do almost anything. I think, for example, the Christine O'Donnell endorsement in Delaware, which Mitt Romney didn't exactly beg for, but he had to say nice things about her after she endorsed him.
You know where she endorsed him? Was in Salem. I thought that was ironic.
I thought that was a bit of an ironic touch. Yes.
You know, what my favorite part of that whole story, and this is my favorite, there was an email that came out that night. It says, from Romney for president, Christine O'Donnell endorses Mitt Romney. Within seconds, there was an email from the DNC that said, Christine O'Donnell endorses Romney. I mean, they didn't even just,
Yes, the DNC is having fun these days.
They said, did you know that Christine O'Donnell and Mike Castle both endorse Mitt Romney? That's kind of a...
See, that's the first thing those two people have agreed on, except the spelling of Delaware, and I think they had to argue about the latter. Look, we need to talk about this other institution besides the presidency. Actually, the first article of the Constitution says Congress shall make all laws. How are they doing with that? Okay.
No, I mean, this is the thing that just drives me nuts about this whole thing, is that I'm trying to figure out why the approval ratings for Congress is so low.
Why are they so high? How could you get 13% saying they approve of Congress? Oh, and in one poll, 3% said they thought this was the best Congress ever.
Is that true?
Yes. Now, my point here is that this expression, best ever, has come to have an ironic meaning. So that when you say to people, how would you rate this Congress? Best ever? A certain number of people are just going to go, yeah, okay. The best ever. And that's why you got 3% giving that answer.
Well, look, we're back to these.
The government's going to shut down, Ken. The government's going to shut down.
Henny penny for president. I mean, this is exactly what we've been doing for all year. I think the American public is sick of it. They roll their eyes, and you know that they're going to be rescued at the last second, and you know that it's going to happen.
How many people do you think understand at this point that they may suddenly be paying another $1,000 a household or whatever in
payroll
taxes?
It's not going to happen because they won't come to an agreement by the end of the year.
They might not.
Of course they will.
I'm not so sure because there are poison pills in there and the House may just leave.
Well, no,
and if the House just leaves and leaves the Senate still holding the bag, then the Senate will not accept everything that the House has left
just
them
as the Democrats,
all the poison pills, and therefore there would be no payroll tax.
Just as the Democrats have now agreed to stop talking about the surtax on the millionaires, the surtax.
And what did they get in exchange for that, by the way?
Well, they may get the dropping of the pipeline thing. Who knows? I know that. But that may be it.
Great bargain.
Look, the point is that we've seen this over and over again. Nothing changes. It'll be one party will blame the other party, and then suddenly something will happen. They could just punt until the next year and say, we'll have a stopgap and a spending bill.
That doesn't take care of the payroll tax cut, which will go away, and everyone will see their first paycheck in January have much, much more money taken out for Social Security.
It's not going to happen.
And people are going to notice that. It's a chunk. It's substantial. It's sizable. People will know.
The Democrats are the first one to blink so far. They did take away the surtax on the millionaires.
We figured they probably would, but it's not clear how much they're getting for that.
Right, and I suspect that the Republicans will have to back down on the pipeline from Canada to the Gulf states because they will.
We expect they will. But there are also a lot of people within the House Republican caucus, a lot of what we refer to as the Tea Party caucus, even though not all of them are associated with the Tea Party, and some of them have been around in Congress for years, but people who see this as their opportunity to really go pedal to the metal and to really push the Democrats hard on a lot of these issues, even though theoretically half of the Congress, the Senate, is in Democratic hands, they have a very hard time running the Senate because of the 60-vote rule and because the Senate is the Senate and everyone's out for themselves.
Speaking of the Tea Party and the influence in the Senate and the Republican Conference, a little surprise this week when Roy Blunt, Mr. Establishment, who is Mitt Romney's conduit in the Senate, beat Ron Johnson.
The freshman senator from Wisconsin.
From Wisconsin, who was elected on Tea Party support, solid Tea Party support. It's a defeat.
The vice chairman of the Republican Conference will now be Roy Blunt of Missouri.
As opposed to Ron Johnson. But look, Ron Johnson had the support of Jim DeMint, Mike Lee, Rand Paul.
All the real Tea Party guys.
That's right.
And what was the final vote?
25-22.
Now, that's awfully close, considering that Roy Blunt is the guy who's been around in Congress. He's been a leader in the House.
He was minority whip and briefly minority leader, right?
And
majority
leader. Would have been thought of as the absolute lead pipe cinch to win this job. But clearly, the Senate Republicans are divided almost right down the middle.
Wait, are you saying that
between the more conventional people following Mitch McConnell and the more Tea Party-oriented people who are following Jim DeMint?
Are you saying that Johnson did better than expected or Blunt did better?
I'm saying Johnson did better than expected because in the old Senate...
Let me tell you why I disagree with you in a second.
All right, go right ahead. But in the old Senate, you essentially waited your turn. You got these things wired up. And Blunt was well out ahead on that. And Blunt is much more the inside operator. Ron Johnson was clearly running for this as a sort of a symbolic gesture.
No, I think because it's the establishment who's taking up all the other positions, like Mitch McConnell, like with Lamar Alexander leaving, it'll be John Thune. Maybe John Cornyn replaces John Kyle
as the number two.
Johnson has been running for months now, ever since Lamar Alexander said he would leave the leadership. Roy Blunt only announced his candidacy last week.
Yeah, but this is the way the Senate used to do business. And you're saying essentially they needed to balance the leadership team, that they needed somebody who was clearly a Tea Party person in the leadership team somewhere. But this isn't just really a team. This is a ladder. This is where people are waiting to move up. They're not necessarily cooperating all that well with each other. Sometimes they don't get along very well.
Well, that's the whole
point.
That's why Mitch McConnell, whether Roy Blunt has been running for months or for 5 minutes, I suspect that Mitch McConnell wanted his people close to him, and his people did not include a Jim DeMint-backed candidate in Johnson. And another establishment Republican who seems to have gotten some kind of a good news this week is Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin. He's been getting his head bashed in by the Club for Growth, by conservatives, by Jim DeMint for months. Mike Huckabee endorsed former Governor Tommy Thompson for the Herb Kohl Senate seat in Wisconsin this week. And so every time you think that, you know, the moderates, the establishment guys are gone, something like this happens.
So good news for Tommy Thompson, still running against two guys in that Wisconsin primary, which doesn't actually resolve until September, but clearly one of the most interesting Senate primaries in either party in 2012. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me?